Israel reacts to the American resolution at the UN Security Council.
I think they see the U.S. agreement to support the resolution as intended mostly to exert pressure on Hamas to accept this hostage release and ceasefire proposal.
Plus, a sleepless night in Kyiv.
Throughout the night, Ukrainians heard the sound of air raid alerts and air defense mixed with powerful thunder and lightning. At one point, those sounds were mixed and created a feeling of being inside of a horror movie.
And later, Hungary and NATO reach an agreement, and North and South Korea are still trading propaganda and garbage balloons. Today is Wednesday, June 12th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We'll take a look at the upcoming G7 summit in a moment, but first we'll check in on Israel and Gaza. The UN Security Council approved a U.S. resolution calling for a ceasefire, this after the U.S. vetoed similar resolutions before. What's been the reaction in Israel to America's change of heart? To find out, I'm joined by VOA's Ricky Rosen in Tel Aviv.
I think they see the U.S. agreement to support the resolution as intended mostly to exert pressure on Hamas to accept this hostage release and ceasefire proposal that was presented by President Biden last week. And he said that it was actually an Israeli proposal. So Israel was not opposed to the U.S. move to support this proposal, which was supposed to have been initiated by Netanyahu and the Israeli government. And they saw it as an effort to pressure Hamas.
So we hear journalists like yourself just saying, Biden said this was an Israeli proposal. But what we don't hear are Israelis saying, yes, this is our proposal. This is what we want. Was it an Israeli proposal? How do the Israeli people, the politicians feel about it? Is Israel on board with where this is going?
I think this is an example of Netanyahu's really incredible skills, if you will, in creating spin. Because when the proposal was announced by Biden, there was silence coming from the prime minister's office. A day or two later, the prime minister's office confirmed that this was, in fact, a proposal that was offered by Netanyahu's coalition government. That created a huge explosion within the government, where in which the far-right ministers said that if, in fact, they weren't allowed to see a copy of the proposal, but if in fact what Biden was talking about was something that Israel was supporting, they would withdraw from the government and the government would be brought down. Then Netanyahu said that there were actually some gaps between what Biden was talking about and what he had proposed, but that the general contours of the agreement were supported by Israel. They are supported by the majority of the Israeli public who desperately want to see the hostages released and understand that even after Saturday's military rescue of four hostages, which the country really felt happier, I think, than any time during the last 8 months about. But that was not something that would be realistic to achieve the release of 100 plus 120 more Israeli hostages being held. And so Israel needs a hostage deal, and the Biden hostage deal, and in some form or another, the Netanyahu hostage deal was something that could be supported.
I'm glad you brought up the military action, the raid to free the hostages. A different UN agency accused Israel of war crimes for that raid, saying that the civilian death was disproportionate to the benefit from it. But importantly, they also are accusing Hamas of war crimes for keeping these hostages in residential buildings amongst civilians. What's the public reaction been?
I think the major public reaction in Israel was, as I said, of elation to see the rescue of the hostages. And the typical response was, if you don't want the IDF to come into your homes, then don't hold hostages there, because all four hostages were rescued from civilian homes. In fact, one of them was the house of a journalist and photographer who had worked for Al Jazeera, not as staff, but had sold his work to Al Jazeera. And he and his family were killed as a result of the raid to free the hostage.
So while all of this negotiation, this talking back and forth with the UN, Blinken was just in the region talking about Gaza, there's another fight going on. It's receiving a lot less attention, but that's the fight to Israel's north with Hezbollah in Lebanon. It's been getting worse over the past few days. Can you give us an update on what's happening there?
Yes. So today there were over 200 rockets that were fired from Lebanon into Israel's north, causing 160, I believe, incidences of wildfires all over the north. Some rockets hit schools. Many of the rockets were deflected by the Iron Dome. Some fell in open fields, and some caused extensive damage to property. But we haven't heard yet reports of people who were injured or killed. And this has been a reaction to an Israeli strike on South Lebanon, which killed, they say, the most senior Hezbollah commander that they have killed yet in this conflict between Hezbollah and Israel that's been going on since October 7th and the war in Gaza started.
And we're going to leave it there for today. VOA's Ricky Rosen in Tel Aviv. Ricky, thanks for your reporting today.
Thank you.
At the Group of Seven summit this week, U.S. President Joe Biden will seek an agreement on using interest from frozen Russian assets to aid Ukraine's war effort. He'll also push for unity in tackling global challenges such as infrastructure funding, artificial intelligence, and Chinese overcapacity in green technologies. However, as White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswaro reports, a shift towards the right in the European political landscape could complicate his plans.
As Russian forces advance on the battlefield in Ukraine and war funding fatigue settles more deeply among American and European taxpayers, the U.S. wants the Group of Seven leading industrialized nations to provide Kyiv with a $50 billion loan to be paid back using interest from the approximately $280 billion in Russian assets immobilized in Western financial institutions. President Joe Biden spoke with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in Paris last week.
The United States is standing with you. You are the bulwark against the aggression that's taking place.
Having quadrupled tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles and other key sectors last month, Biden now wants the G7 to confront Beijing's practice of flooding global markets with cheap exports in those industries. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen.
It's critical that we and the growing number of countries who have identified this as a concern present a clear and united front.
However, far-right parties' gains in European Parliament elections over the weekend have weakened French President Emmanuel Macron and German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, adding uncertainty to the G7's posture on Russia and China. Ursula von der Leyen is fighting to remain European Commission president for another term. If she succeeds, Europe is expected to remain strong on Russia and China. said Liana Fix, fellow for Europe at the Council on Foreign Relations via Skype.
But the wild card really are the French elections here, the snap elections that Emmanuel Macron has announced after his defeat in the European parliamentary elections. If the far right gets into government in France, then we will have trouble not only on Ukraine support, but also on the China front.
G7 host Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has invited Pope Francis to highlight the Rome call for AI ethics, urging governments and companies to follow ethical principles for AI. Curbing migration to Europe by investing in Africa is another key theme of Meloni's G7 presidency. The initiative aligns with the G7's Partnership for Global Infrastructure and Investment, whose goal is to mobilize $600 billion in private infrastructure funding by 2027 as an alternative to the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative. Meloni's far-right Brothers of Italy party victory in the European parliamentary election has consolidated her power. She said she's proud Italy will be represented at the G7 with the strongest government of all. Biden leaves for Italy on Wednesday, a day after his son Hunter Biden was found guilty on federal charges of obtaining a gun in 2018 while addicted to drugs. Patsy Wiraguswara, VOA News at the White House.
In other European diplomacy news, Hungary will not block NATO plans to take over coordination of Western military support for Ukraine. Jens Stoltenberg is NATO's Secretary General.
So what the Prime Minister and I have agreed today is that Hungary will not block other allies to agree a pledge for financial support to Ukraine and a leading role for NATO in coordinating support to Ukraine.
Under plans backed by Stoltenberg, NATO would take over coordination of arms donations and supplies from the U.S.-led Ukraine Defense Contact Group, also known as the Ramstein Group. The alliance would also coordinate the training of Ukrainian forces, an activity in which both the EU and Britain are heavily involved. Hungary opposes the plans, arguing it brings the alliance closer to a catastrophic war with Russia. But Stoltenberg told media in Budapest that Hungarian funds and personnel would not be involved in the new effort, and that Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban had assured him that Hungary would not block the proposal. NATO allies are set to discuss Stoltenberg's plan, widely seen as an effort to provide a degree of, quote, Trump-proofing ahead of the U.S. election. And in Ukraine, a heavy storm combined with a massive drone and missile attack rocked the central part of the country, and the Ukrainian military has created a new Unmanned Systems Forces unit. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has more from Kyiv.
Starting Tuesday evening, the central part of Ukraine, mainly the city of Kyiv and the broader Kyiv region, is under a heavy storm with strong wind and rain. The storm continues throughout Wednesday. The amount of precipitation has already exceeded the daily norm by almost 3 times. This caused flooding in some districts of Kyiv and more energy blackout. Meanwhile, Russian forces launched a massive missile and drone attack in the early hours of Wednesday, targeting Kyiv and the Kyiv region, as well as the central and eastern regions of Ukraine. Throughout the night, Ukrainians heard the sound of air raid alerts and air defense, mixed with powerful thunder and lightning. At one point, those sounds were mixed and created a feeling of being inside of a horror movie. The shelling stopped around 4:30 a.m. local time on Wednesday. It was a sleepless night for the citizens of Kyiv, as the capital and the outskirts were one of the main targets of the attack. As a result of the attack, a fire broke out at an industrial facility in the Kyiv region caused by the debris fall. One person was injured. No hits on residential areas or critical infrastructure were recorded. In other news, there is a new department in the Armed Forces of Ukraine. It was announced Wednesday that Deputy Commander-in-Chief Vadim Sukharevsky will head the newly created Unmanned Systems Forces. Sukharevsky is a well-known Ukrainian military man who was the first to open fire on Russian troops in 2014 near Slavyansk at the beginning of the war. He is well known for his expertise in unmanned systems and the development of the use of drones. Sukharevsky also confirmed that Kyiv allies are actively helping Ukraine in the development of this area. The U.S. is involved in both intelligence and the production of drones. According to him, cooperation with France also continues in terms of the modernization of those drones that they plan to deliver to Ukraine. Ukraine also cooperates with Norway, Spain, Canada, and South Korea in all areas at the command level of the unmanned systems forces. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. North and South Korea are at it again, trading blaring propaganda and trash-filled balloons over the border. We'll take a look in a few minutes. First, though, more from Ukraine. Russia says it's holding more than 6,000 Ukrainians as prisoners of war. For many of those who've been released, though, liberation is just the start of a painful process of recovery. From Kyiv, Lysia Bakalets brings the story of one former prisoner of war.
With tears in his eyes, his legs shaking from tension, every day is a painful step in a complex process of rehabilitation for Ukrainian Marine Oleksandr Didur. Didur says the pain is such that he feels like he is in captivity again. He adds that on the pain scale of 0 to 10, he is at an 8 now. After Didur goes swimming, this routine is broken only for additional surgery. Since he was released from captivity a year ago, he's already had about 10 of them. Didur says he had his left hand reassembled and two eye surgeries. From his mouth, doctors removed shrapnel from a mine explosion injury. Oleksandr was injured in Mariupol in 2022 while defending the city from the Russians. Didur remembers last thing he saw was the turn of the tank muzzle, and then it was darkness. His comrades later said the tank shell landed 2 meters from him. In a semi-kosher state, Oleksandr fell into Russian captivity along with other Ukrainian soldiers from the Azovstal steel plant in May 2022. Oleksandr recalls that the prison wardens treated the wounded with a bit more leniency, hitting them on the forehead. Others, he says, were mocked. They were forced to learn and sing the Russian national anthem and 14 other songs of theirs. A UN report in March concluded that torture of Ukrainian POWs in Russian internment is widespread. The same report says Russian POWs were tortured by Ukrainian forces while in transit. Both Russian and Ukrainian officials have said they respect the rights of prisoners. Oleksandr was held captive for 15 months before returning to his family as part of a prisoner exchange nearly a year ago. Oleksandr's daughter, Lisa, remembers asking her mother, "Will Dad die there?" She says she was afraid every day. Without one eye and with 3 remaining fingers on his right hand, Didur does his best to get back to normality. He has learned to write again, all while trying to maintain a positive attitude. Didur says his handwriting is actually better now than before, when he had all his fingers. Each day brings pain, but also progress, and he thinks of how each day brings him closer to not only recovery, but the release of his comrades who are still held captive. Lysia Bakalets, VOA News, Kyiv.
Tension is rising on the Korean Peninsula, and it looks like Pyongyang is strengthening its ties with Moscow. Reuters' Sakir Jasny has more.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un called his country an invincible ally of Russia in state media Tuesday, while rumors swirl that President Vladimir Putin is set to visit. Marking Russia's National Day, Kim said his meeting with Putin last year strengthened their century-old strategic relationship. The message followed a report that Putin will soon visit North Korea and Vietnam, but no date has been confirmed. Kim visited Russia last September, touring the Vostochny Cosmodrome spaceport in the Russian Far East, where Putin promised assistance in satellite construction. Tuesday's state media report also had Kim praising Russia for achieving success in building a strong nation, despite facing pressures from, quote, hostile forces. In the past year, Pyongyang and Moscow have boosted diplomatic and security ties and traded delegations in recent months. A North Korean public security delegation was scheduled to visit Russia this week. Officials in Washington and Seoul have accused North Korea of exchanging weapons for use in Russia's conflict in Ukraine in exchange for aid with its nuclear and missile programs.
That's Sakir Jasny of Reuters reporting for us. And North Korea's relationship with Russia might be improving, but inter-Korean relations have sunk to their lowest level in years. This comes as both countries intensify cross-border psychological warfare. The developments began with North Korea sending waste-filled balloons into the South. VOA's Bill Gallo reports.
South Korea's military is tracking not missiles, but balloons. North Korea has sent thousands in waves, scattering trash across the South, and in some cases, dropping feces. It's a symbolic protest against South Korean activists who send forbidden materials into the North. For North Korea's leaders, any unapproved content is an existential threat. Chad O'Carroll is the founder of NK News.
Outside information is really ideological contamination. It's like a cancer, and it's a serious Achilles heel for Kim Jong-un.
That weakness is being exploited by South Korea, which is now blaring propaganda across the border. Those loudspeakers were last used 6 years ago. North Korea has installed its own speakers, a tit-for-tat escalation. Though all is quiet for now, many residents are concerned. Nam Song-jun is a Gimpo resident. He says people are anxious, and he served in the military, so he thinks about how much trouble soldiers on the front lines are going through right now. Song Mo-ran is a Seoul resident. She says it's stupid to resort to doing the same thing as the other person. She hopes we can sit down and talk to each other soon. In 2020, North Korea destroyed an inter-Korean office as part of a backlash against South Korean leaflets. North Korea has also fired toward loudspeakers in the past. Kim Byung-ju is a South Korean lawmaker. He says the two Koreas are playing a game of chicken, like a runaway train. We keep doing this power-for-power confrontation, he says. He's very worried about tensions. But the leaflet launches are unlikely to stop. Some activists appear emboldened.
For balloon launchers that rely upon a lot of reporters coming out to a pre-announced launch, this is a boon for them.
Pastor Eric Foley operates more quietly, sending Bibles to what he says are North Korea's underground Christians. He disputes the idea that tensions would improve if the launches stopped.
That kind of trickle-down view on human rights hasn't proven to be effective so far. It hasn't proven to improve the relations between the countries or improve the situation of North Koreans.
For now, inter-Korean interaction amounts to exchanges of poop-filled balloons and propaganda, a depressing low point that many fear could soon get lower. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Paju, South Korea.
And finally today, hundreds of thousands of religious pilgrims are arriving in Saudi Arabia for the Hajj, the annual Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca. The AP's Charles de Ledesma has more.
Muslim pilgrims have been streaming into Saudi Arabia's holy city of Mecca for the Hajj. As the annual pilgrimage returns to its monumental scale, Saudi officials say more than 1.5 million foreign pilgrims have arrived in Mecca so far. More are expected, and hundreds of thousands of Saudis and others living in the state will also join them when the pilgrimage officially begins on Friday. The pilgrim numbers include 4,200 Palestinians from the occupied West Bank. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are not able to travel to the state for Hajj this year because of the 8-month war between Israel and Hamas. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.